From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The auto industry in survival mode. Hello again, I'm Aaron Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. GM and Chrysler have just 2 weeks till a presidential task force decides if their viability plans will do the job or if they'll have to go bankrupt. But across the board, auto sales are in free fall, especially among the gasoline-saving hybrids beloved by politicians who want the industry to turn green. How important is the price of gasoline? How difficult is getting a loan? Are car sales tied to housing? We'll talk with the world's biggest Ford dealer and others about the present and future of the automobile. What would an intelligent transportation system look like? On Reporter's Notebook later on, what's next for Pakistan? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. GM and Chrysler may be on the verge of bankruptcy, but auto sales are declining so fast the entire industry is in trouble. We'll assess the prospects for its survival and what the future might look like. On Reporter's Notebook, Pakistan confronts instability amid hopes of democratic reform. First, this news update. The failed insurance company AIG paid 73 executives bonuses of $1 million or more. 11 of those aren't even with the company anymore. Iowa's Republican Senator Charles Grassley suggested drastic action.
The first thing that would make me feel a little bit better towards them, if they'd follow the Japanese example and come before the American people and take that deep bow and say, I'm sorry, and then either do one of two things, resign or go commit suicide.
Senator Charles Grassley speaking yesterday. Today, Democrats began writing bills to require that the $165 million in bonuses paid for with taxpayer dollars be returned. Here's Charles Schumer of New York.
Now, in the past year, we have learned much about the reckless behavior within our financial system. And no firm was more reckless than AIG. What they did was not only irresponsible, but from a business perspective, it was immoral. They took what was a very solid, well-made business that sold insurance to individuals and firms around the globe and turned it into a gambling den that they used to enrich themselves.
Michael Cranish is Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. And Michael, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Rhetoric is at a high pitch in Washington today. Charles Schumer says what they did was not only irresponsible, but from a business perspective, immoral. Does anybody really understand what they did?
Well, you know, the government is looking into that, and the big problem is the U.S. government, the taxpayer, has $170 billion of chips in that game. Schumer called it gambling, and, you know, the big thing here is, will that larger amount of money be gotten back? There's obviously a lot of talk, understandably, about the $165 million in bonuses, but there's this $170 billion that the taxpayers put in. So there's a lot of tension about how far the government wants to go and hoping that the company can at least remain intact to be sold off and get all or most of that investment back.
Back to the $165 million, and it's important to point out, as you just did, that we're talking million here, not $170 billion. Is there any way, really, to get that $165 million back? Are there arguments that legally they didn't really have to pay it?
Well, it depends on which administration official you're talking to. On Sunday, Larry Summers, President Obama's chief economic advisor, basically said these contracts are valid and can't be abrogated. And then yesterday, President Obama said that Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, should pursue every legal avenue to stop them. Now, actually, these bonuses have already been paid, so I don't know if you can stop something already paid. They want to get them back, and that's why Congress today is looking at the possibility of taxing them up to 100% so that effectively they'd be returned.
So you could tax? Wouldn't that be an ex post facto taxation?
I can't tell you whether that would be legal, and I don't know if members of Congress can tell you whether that would be legal. What I know is that they're looking into whatever they can do that might be an option. Clearly what seems to be going on here is they're trying to put public pressure on the company and those executives to simply do this voluntarily. And if not, perhaps they can force their hand. But there's a public pressure strategy here at work.
In the meantime, the Attorney General of the State of New York, Andrew Cuomo, says that he wants a list on his desk by the end of the day of the employees who received the bonuses. It has been reported, as I indicated earlier, that there were 73 such people who got paid more than $1 million each. Are their names public?
No, I'm looking at the same letter that you just referred to. The Attorney General of New York issued a three-page letter to the Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank, who's the chair of the House Financial Services Committee, and that letter is quite remarkable. It does say, as you mentioned, 73 individuals received bonuses of $1 million or more. 11 of the individuals who received retention bonuses, so they'd stay there, have actually left, including one person who got $4.6 million. So this letter, which is just now filtering out through Washington, inevitably will create even more outrage.
And retention was one of the principal reasons for arguing for the bonuses. If they were to allow these people to leave, there wouldn't be anybody around who understood how AIG operated.
Right. I mean, that's the theory, is that you want to retain these people. Other people would argue, look, you know, if your resume is that you brought AIG to its knees, you know, who else would hire you? You'd want to stay there and perhaps help the government and the taxpayers figure out what happened and solve the problem as best can be done.
We haven't mentioned the Secretary of the Treasury, Mr. Geithner, or the man the Obama administration appointed to put in charge of AIG. I believe the Obama administration appointed him. Are the Republicans coming after the Obama administration, blaming them for what's happened?
Well, I mean, clearly a lot of this happened during the Bush administration, but then the Republicans have said the Obama administration has mishandled the ball. You know, I think everyone would agree there's plenty of blame to go around. You know, Senator Grassley made the comment about maybe executives should resign or commit suicide, quite a stark comment, which his spokesperson quickly backtracked from, by the way. But I don't know if there's individuals in the government who have taken the same position as far as, you know, should they resign? Do they admit that they didn't handle this correctly? There's so many problems that have come up as a result of this, and so many changes will be made. Clearly, a lot of people, you know, have answers to give.
All right. We'll be talking about this for a long time to come. Michael Cranish, many thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. In a moment, the auto industry in survival mode on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Alney back with To the Point. President Obama's Automobile Task Force is in Michigan this week to assess the so-called viability plans of Chrysler and General Motors. The task force already has determined not to recall the $17 billion in government loans approved by the Bush administration, and they have emphasized that bankruptcy is not their preferred option. But their final decisions won't be made till the end of this month. David Shepardson reports from Washington for the Detroit News. And, David, good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
What is a viability plan? What does this mean?
Well, if you remember, General Motors and Chrysler both got a total of $17.4 billion in emergency loans at the tail end of the Bush administration to prevent them from being forced into bankruptcy. And as a result, or as part of that plan, they were required to submit these viability plans by February 17th, which they did, in which they had to show the government, this is how we can be profitable, can stand on our own. And as part of that, they're required to make win some tough concessions. First, from their bondholders, they need to slash the amount of debt they have by two-thirds and offer new shares of stock in the company in exchange for that debt. And secondly, they have to cut the cash payments to the United Auto Workers Trust Fund that will take over responsibility for retiree health care in 2010 by about 50%. So between and these concessions are due by March 31st, so they're really, really working under the gun to get that done.
So the companies then are bargaining, presumably with the bondholders and the unions, while the president's task force looks on?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Rick Wagner, the CEO and chairman of General Motors, today said, you know, this isn't two-handed poker. And the implication was you've got, you know, all these different stakeholders. No one wants to go first until they're convinced that the other guys are going to make concessions. So it's a very complex set of negotiations to ensure that they, you know, cut their costs and can get to a point where they can become profitable.
Are there also suppliers involved in these negotiations, the people that that make the parts that right. go into the cars?
You know, the suppliers issue has really gotten very little attention until recently. And the main problem the suppliers have faced is, you remember in December, January, when auto sales really started to tank, the big three basically stopped nearly all auto production for almost a month. I mean, Chrysler shut down its entire set of U.S. factories for just about a month. And as a result, they get paid on a three-month lagging basis. So, you know, this month, many suppliers are seeing little, if any, revenue. And, you know, they've been enduring years of cost cuts and reduced production. So you have a number of major suppliers that are on the brink of bankruptcy. So the task force has to figure out a way to provide some aid to keep these critical suppliers open. Because don't forget, a lot of some of these suppliers that are in trouble also supply Toyota, Honda, Nissan, and so a collapse of the supplier base could, you know, prevent or could see a shutdown of an enormous amount of auto production across the board. So that is sort of the most urgent problem they're facing. The two key advisors to the task force said today they could have they told members of Congress they could have an answer on suppliers as early as this week. So it's a looming problem that they've got to deal with, and there's also auto dealers have sought financial support, so there's many different, you know, moving parts to this whole process.
What about sales?
Well, really interesting issue on sales. Hybrid sales, for example, you know, tanked in January in part because the economy is doing so badly and gas prices have fallen to below $2 a gallon. I mean, it's awfully difficult to go to the Toyota dealership and debate between buying a Toyota Corolla and a Toyota and paying $6,000-$7,000 more for a Prius when it only gets a small increase in fuel efficiency relative to how much money you're going to pay. So, no, it's very, you know, it's a very complex thing. We're seeing a small uptick in SUV sales at the same time that, you know, the policies of the government, we're trying to encourage more fuel efficient vehicles, higher miles per gallon across the board. But the main problem is that, like so many other major purchases, people aren't, you know, opting to buy a car if they don't have to, which is putting lots of dealerships on the brink. And if something doesn't happen, if more cars aren't sold, they're going to have to take some major step to reduce capacity. That means more factories across the board, and potentially even an auto company will have to disappear.
David Shepardson, again, based in Washington for the Detroit News. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Warren.
Car sales are at their lowest level in 28 years, down 41% from February of 2008. GM was down 53%, 48% loss at Ford, 44% at Chrysler, 40% at Toyota, 38% at Honda. Bert Bachman is owner of Galpin Ford in Los Angeles. That is the largest Ford dealership in the world. Bert Bachman, thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you.
You're not just in the business yourself. Your whole family's been in the business for a very long time, 55 years in your case. Have you ever seen it this bad?
No, I've never seen it as difficult as it is today. I've been in through a number of recessions that we've had in the past, but nothing has touched this one. And most particularly, the last quarter of last year and the beginning of this year have really exasperated what was a very, very tough market.
Sounds like it's happening very fast.
Well, it accelerated very fast. Actually, there's been a slowdown for the big three for about the last 3 years. Mm. And we saw that accelerate dramatically in the last quarter. And at the same time, we picked up those that had not been as affected, such as Toyota and Honda, which during the high gas prices had rather increased their penetration in the market.
You have seen recessions, problems like this in the past, you said. What has saved you?
Well, it's never been this severe, so it wasn't a case of saving us. But I know in 1990, in the period of early 90, you might remember we had a recession then. And for the Ford dealers, the vehicle that saved them at that time was the Explorer. We came out with that car. We had a great volume on the car, and it was highly accepted. It was the first one of its kind and hit the market very strong and was very profitable for the dealers. Unfortunately, we don't have that product right here today, meaning by that a product that's selling in high numbers. Everything is down. It doesn't matter whose product it is, whether it's import or whether it's a big three product, sales are just dramatically slow.
There's a lot of political sentiment in Washington for the idea that hybrids will be the car of the future and perhaps save the energy if it's able to retool quickly enough to turn green. Do you agree with that?
No. The reason I don't agree with hybrids in that vein, and I don't mean they're not helpful, it just takes an awful long time to pay for the benefit they provide because their primary benefit in mileage is around 45, 50 miles an hour. And typically, at least here where I'm at, the freeways, you're either zero or you're 70. There's not a lot in between. So it takes a long time to pay the cost difference. As that cost would come down near the price of a car that's not a hybrid, that probably would assist. And we will sell more hybrids in the future, but it just won't be a dramatic, nor is it an answer to the problem.
What do you think is the principal reason that your business has dropped as fast as it has, as deeply as it has?
Well, today, it's what I would call the current recession we're in, the fact that we have, particularly here in California, we've been hit the hardest. And I think an awful lot of that had to do with, of course, our home positions before, where even though people were spending very quickly, they were getting values increasing in their homes, and they were using them like ATM machines. If they needed money, they draw it on their house. So that you had an awful lot of people that really were spending at very high amounts, and when the value in the homes began to change, that affected things rather dramatically. And California, being the leader in that, I believe suffered the most.
Apparently Florida is also suffering a great deal, and so is Nevada. Interestingly, places where home sales are also, or the home industry is also in big trouble.
That's 1, 2, 3. It's California number one, Florida number two, and Nevada number three.
So there's a real connection then between the cars and the houses.
Absolutely.
What about demand and finance? Are they obviously demand is down, but is finance another reason?
It depends on your credit. If you've had good credit in the past, you should not have a difficulty unless you have negative equity in your car, meaning you owe more than it's worth. In the past, the manufacturers, captive companies, and the banks have tended to loan more on a car than just the value of the car. That has changed rather dramatically. So today, you really need to have either a break-even going in, and you can get 100% financing, but you have to have outstanding credit to do that, or with a typical down payment, somewhere around 10 to 20%, you would have to have at least reasonable credit.
What about used cars and servicing?
Well, service and parts, of course, have been something that can be an upward trend for the dealer if he focuses on it, because if the people keep the cars longer, they're getting service on the vehicles. And some of them may delay the service, but most people will get it done on a somewhat regular basis, as opposed to a car where almost everybody can put that purchase off for another year. Used cars have not been affected as much as new. You've had a number of people that have shown interest there. They've dropped in the area of 20 to 25% at most dealerships, where car sales, as you pointed out, are in the area of around 40% here in California.
You opened in 1946 with the Bachmann Enterprises. Have you ever laid anybody off?
Well, actually, I joined the company. The original owner was Galpin in 1953.
All right.
But from 1946 until last year, we never had a layoff at Galpin. And that was a very, very painful experience for us because we have a huge number of very, very long-time employees.
So you had to let some of those people go?
We did.
In what numbers and what percentages?
Well, fortunately, we let attrition take care of some of it, meaning we had people retiring, et cetera. But we did lay off approximately 10% of our working force, and we still are viewing jobs today and trying to put jobs together to cut a little bit further. But in that case, we can let some of our people who are ready to retire take that time off.
Are you able to be optimistic at all?
Yes, actually, right now I feel more optimistic than I have in a long time. I think I see the light at the end of the tunnel. It may be a little bit away, but I feel much better about what I'm hearing from the people coming in the door and the people that I'm talking to and our customers.
And what about the President's Task Force in Michigan? Do you think they will allow GM and Chrysler to go bankrupt or not?
Well, first of all, bankrupt may not be what it means. In other words, if you're saying go out of business and stay out of business, it would be different from perhaps a bankruptcy where you try to reformulate and come back in some other form. I do think Chrysler has a very, very difficult time in the future. I think GM does, but that's because they have so many brands and all, and as you noticed, they're planning to cut some of those off. Being a Saturn dealer, I'm very, very sensitive to that.
All right, Bert Bachmann, not only a Saturn dealer, but the biggest Ford dealer in the entire world. It's good to have you on our program, and good luck for the future.
Thank you very much.
Wes Brown is a principal at Iceology. That's a Los Angeles-based consumer research firm. And, Wes Brown, welcome to you. Tell us, if you will, Wes Brownie with us?
Yes, I am.
There you are. Tell us, based on in part on what you heard from Bert Bachman, does he reflect what you have learned about consumers and the way they're looking at the automobile business right now?
Yeah, I think he's absolutely dead on the money. As he mentioned, starting last year in the final quarter and into this year, we've just seen consumers effectively become paralyzed when it comes to spending money in general, and especially when it comes to spending money on big purchases like a vehicle. Again, I think as Bert mentioned, initially when the slowdown occurred in the at the end of the summer last year into the fall with the economy, it was financing was an issue for consumers, and they started to come in and were being turned down because of financing. So then effectively the word got out, so people didn't even bother to go into the showroom because they just feared, they didn't want to be embarrassed and humiliated by not being able to get financing. And then as the year came to a close and into the beginning of this year, consumer confidence completely tanked. So now people just don't even have confidence right now to even bother to walk anywhere near a dealership. But then again, I think as Bert is saying, we're hopeful, as I think many of their auto manufacturers are, that we're reaching the bottom maybe this month, if not last month, so that hopefully we will start to see a slow, gradual return of confidence, and then consumers will start to come back into the showrooms.
General Motors says that customers won't buy their cars if they're in bankruptcy, even if it's the restructuring kind of bankruptcy that Bert Bachman talked about. Do you agree with that?
I think we've actually had internal debate on what that would mean if GM had to go into that type of, take those kinds of steps, and what the consumer would do. And we're ultimately, I think, a little bit of on both sides of the camp. I think for the loyal GM person, they're going to come in and buy anyway. That's not going to be an issue. They're ultimately going to believe GM will be there for them, so they will continue to come and shop. The difficulty for General Motors, if they're in that situation, is going to be trying to attract the non-GM person, and most definitely the person who typically doesn't even shop a domestic brand, so that import-oriented consumer who's been buying the Hondas and the Toyotas, the Nissans, what have you. Those types of consumers will probably be quite scared about wanting to walk in the door and effectively taking a chance or a risk in their minds of purchasing a vehicle from a company that they don't know if it's going to be around in the future how it will be around.
Why are the sales of hybrids going down faster than those of others? And let me just mention, we have very few seconds left. Let me ask for a short answer, and I'll let you finish it when we come back.
Sure. Quite simply, at $2, $2.30 a gallon, the need for a hybrid has completely changed in the consumer's mind.
Okay. Wes Brown at Iceology, that's a Los Angeles-based consumer research. We'll continue this conversation with him, with Peter DeLorenzo, publisher and founder of AutoExtremist.com, and Bill Reinert, the national manager for Toyota's Advanced Technology Group. And on Reporter's Notebook, democracy and instability in Pakistan. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. Going to talk in a moment about the future of the automobile industry. Right now we're talking about its present state, which is pretty much the worst in the history of the industry, certainly since World War II. Wes Brown is with us, principal at Iceology, the Los Angeles-based consumer research firm. You said that the sales of hybrids are going down because people aren't going to spend that extra money because of they're not going to save anything due to the price of gasoline. What about the arguments for global warming, the arguments for getting off gasoline, dependence on foreign oil? Do those things matter to consumers at all?
Well, I think those are very legitimate arguments, and I think if you were to stop and ask the average consumer about those and very pointed issues, of course, they're all going to tell you that they're, very high on their list of things they are concerned about and want, this government and the world to change. However, if you go back and you, effectively watch how hybrid sales grew since they came about, I can't remember, it was a decade ago maybe with the first Prius. Originally, again, the vehicles were positioned as the green alternative, and the group of buyers who went out and bought them right away were those who were the most extreme when it came to wanting to save the environment and specifically sacrifice themselves about, to change. Then the next gen Prius came out, which is the one that's out currently. And again, that's how it was positioned, about saving, helping the world, saving the environment, making the world a better place. However, once gas started to jump in price during last year, the tone of hybrids from a marketing standpoint changed, and it was all about fuel economy, and that's all it was about. So What you got then were those people who jumped on board right away, because when you're paying, you know, $3, $3.50, $4 and above a gallon, you know, all you're worried about at that point is, oh, my Lord, look what I've been paying for gasoline. Look how much it's costing me to fill up. I've got to do something about that. Here's a vehicle that they're telling me gets 50 miles to a gallon. That's what I want. And people went hysterical and jumped on board right away. It had nothing to do with green at that point in time. It was purely about my look at my pocketbook. I need to find a way to cut that cost. As gas fell up, you know, gas prices fell down. You know, we've seen no one wants a hybrid anymore. It just doesn't matter to them because now I'm paying $2.25 a gallon. I can drive what I've been driving. I can go back to my big vehicles. I can stick with my big vehicle, which is effectively what we're seeing. People aren't buying new. They're just saying, well, I don't need to get rid of my big truck anymore or my big car because now I'm back to only spending $35 or $40 to fill it up instead of $75. So the need for a hybrid has waned because, again, it was all about fuel economy last year. I think ultimately what we're going to have to see during this, I'll call it short to midterm time, when we see gas at a level that we're paying right now, for hybrids to succeed, they're going to have to be repositioned as what they were originally designed for, which was you get good gas mileage and you're doing something about saving the environment and global warming, emissions, all those types of things. And I think that's what the success model is going to be in the short to midterm until gas, you know, eventually goes higher again, which, you know, everyone I think is pretty much knows is going to happen.
Yeah, that could happen, and it can happen fast. It certainly went up and then came down very quickly. So if it did happen, is it possible then that the demand for the hybrids might shoot up again?
Yeah, I think, again, if to your point, that becomes the question. When gas goes back up, and again, everyone says it's going to happen, will it be gradual and take its time? At which point, I think if that does occur, then we won't see the hysteria around hybrids like we witnessed last year, because if it is a more gradual increase, then you kind of get used to, as a consumer psychologically, to each of these new price points, and you don't suddenly feel this rush of panic that we saw again last year, which was also around uncertainty of every day you woke up, you drove by the gas station, and it seemed like gas went up 10 or 20 cents.
Yeah.
So you just had no way of planning. If it jumps and we see an increase on a steep hill like we witnessed last year, then yes, I think you would see the hysteria return around people looking for hybrids and anything that gets them 45, 50 miles per gallon. Again, recognizing also with all of this that, you know, with the government and the mandate on CAFE, when we start looking 5 to 10 years, you know, 5 years out, every vehicle has to become more efficient, period, to meet these new CAFE standards. So that also will then play into the mind of the consumers. Well, I can get 35 miles per gallon on this mid-size car a few years from now, or do I go to 45 but get a vehicle that's smaller and doesn't meet all of my needs? And that's going to play into the psychology of consumers also and what they end up buying.
Okay. Wes Brown, again, a principal at Iceology, Los Angeles-based consumer research firm. Many thanks to you.
Sure, no problem. Anytime.
Peter DeLorenzo is founder and publisher of AutoExtremist.com. That's an internet magazine devoted to analyzing the automotive industry. He's a consultant to auto companies, former automotive advertising executive. Peter DeLorenzo, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here today.
We know that, as just mentioned, CAFE standards are being pushed by the Obama administration and in the Congress as well. There's great pressure on the American companies to develop hybrids and electric cars as well. Presuming that the price of gasoline does rise relatively quickly, is that going to save the industry?
I don't think it's, you know, I think it will help. I think speaking to some of the points that were made earlier, the consumer will have a lot more choices. It won't be the Prius hanging out by itself. You know, it has already been joined by the new Honda Civic Hybrid, and the domestic manufacturers will add new and competitive hybrid-type vehicles as we go forward. Will it save the industry? Not by itself. I think there are too many needs, too many vehicle needs for different people all across the nation. Hybrids don't always fit what they need. I think the hybrid movement will contribute going forward when these new standards start going into effect. I think that, you know, they will have to grab more of a share of the U.S. market, but they won't save the U.S. industry by themselves.
What happens if you're in the automobile business and when there's this kind of uncertainty, and it seems to me there's a great deal of uncertainty, you make the wrong decision? How expensive can that be?
Well, it can be huge. And one thing that I think the average person, and certainly the average representative in Washington, finds it difficult to understand is this concept of lead time in the business. You're making decisions about products that at the earliest might come out within 3 years, maybe 2.5 years. Lots of things can change in that time frame, as we found out last summer when gas spiked and the American manufacturers were overloaded with, you know, large SUVs and larger vehicles and pickups. So it's very difficult to anticipate. But I think every manufacturer will tell you today that they are banking on higher gas prices going forward. I don't think there's any doubt in anyone's mind that that's the direction that we're going.
But is the Obama administration, do you think, pushing them too fast and they might be pushing them to make decisions that won't pay off in the long term or that won't pay off as well as they hope?
Well, that is a danger. The biggest issue facing the Obama administration, I believe, right now is not only the viability of General Motors and Chrysler and Ford, for that matter, but how to get consumer confidence up to get people to buy now. It's one thing to talk about, well, we see a jolly green world going forward, and we're all going to be driving happy cars that don't emit, you know, pollution and get great mileage. But we have to get the industry going, and they can't put too many restrictive fuel economy rules on the industry too quickly, or it will kill any momentum that they can generate over the next, I think, 18 months.
On the other hand, from the standpoint of those who are worried about global warming and energy independence, you want to start as soon as possible.
Absolutely. But, you know, it's a fine line between where we want to go and how soon we want to get there, and we can't cripple our own industry trying to get there too soon.
Again, Peter DiLorenzo is founder and publisher of AutoExtremist.com. Stay with us, as I know you will, for the rest of our program. I want to introduce our final guest, Bill Reinert, who's national manager for Toyota's Advanced Technology Group. And, Bill Reinert, it's good to have you back on our program.
Good to be back on your program.
Do you agree that the government could put too much pressure and distort the industry to the point where it might make it more difficult for them to survive rather than easier?
Oh, sure. That's always a chance that it happens when you have regulatory forces that are in opposition to where the customer wants to go. And that's not just true from a federal point of view, but it's also true from a California point of view or from a state-by-state point of view. So as was pointed out earlier, we have some pretty stringent CAFE regulations coming on. We might have a low-carbon fuel standard that we're looking at. And we've got consumers who are worried about just making day-to-day purchases and are not at all interested in high fuel efficiency cars right now.
So you think then that the market for green, at the moment at least, is pretty weak?
Well, I think there's people would like to associate with green, whether they have the money to pay extra for that, and whether from a regulatory point of view we've really defined what green is. I think those are all questions we have to answer over the next few years.
Has Toyota made money on the Prius?
We're starting to make money on the Prius. We didn't at first, of course, but we are now.
Starting to make money, but it's been going for quite a while.
Yes, and if you get into cost accounting from an automobile firm, it's almost impossible to find out what exactly is charged to what account.
like making a movie.
Yeah, exactly right. No, at first we had to pay back a significant investment in the R&D and the materials development to make the first drivetrain.
Well, we just heard from Peter DiLorenzo that you have to think ahead 3 years perhaps, or maybe 2.5 years when you're manufacturing a car. When you do what you do with the Advanced Technology Group, how far ahead are you thinking?
2050.
2050?
Yeah. And by the way, if you're doing powertrains, you're 5 to 6 years out. If you're going to do a minor model change, that's 2 to 3 years. But we're launching the new Prius, and we're already thinking about what groups we put together to do its replacement.
Wow. And that would be when?
The replacement. This car is going to have longer life. So probably another 6 years from now, 2015.
How's it going to be different from the Prius we have now?
Oh, it's going to be lighter, probably have a little different battery technology, more fuel efficiency, keep working on the aerodynamics, and reducing the carbon content of the interior plastics.
So you're still then talking about individual transportation in cars. When you're talking about 2050, as I understand it, you're talking about transportation systems, something much broader, and that requires a lot of coordination between different types of transportation.
Well, and in fact, we're talking about transportation systems in light of my working time that I have left at Toyota in the next 5 years. When you start to address the needs of transportation in an urban environment, in a high-density urban environment, and you've got distinctly a growing anti-car sentiment coming from Europe and in the cities in the United States, and basically it's hard to make a case that there will be strong markets for individually owned cars. The second thing is we do have regulatory issues here in California that would dictate we look at some zero-emission car in fairly large quantities, and not just in California, in several other states. So when you start looking at that and you start looking at how you might make money on that, you start seeing that we might do specific cars as part of a transportation system.
What does that mean? When you say there's anti-car sentiment, obviously people have to get around whether they like the car or not. Elaborate a little bit on anti-car sentiment.
Well, you see it a little bit with congestion pricing in the U.K., and of course there's been some backlash on that. But essentially, just walk around New York. Most people that live in the city don't want a car. It's not that they're really anti-car, it's that there's no use for the car. There's no place to park it, no place to garage it, and the streets are incredibly congested.
So that with that sentiment building, then what is Toyota thinking about if you're not going to be able to sell cars in the city? What are you going to be able to sell?
Well, you think about a situation that might be you're providing mobility services. So we might make maybe a small electric car. In fact, at Detroit this year, we showed the ideas of what we're thinking about, which is a two-person or three-person city electric car, but not necessarily to be sold in individual buyers. So it might be used with a company like Zipcar where you do car sharing, or it might be part of a combined with some advanced technology devices, BlackBerries and iPhones and such like. It might be part of a mass transit system where you get off the subway or you get off the light rail, and to make that last 5 miles to the office, you get a car subscription service to get you to work and back.
So how soon do you think that we're going to see that kind of systemized approach?
The technology, in fact, is available pretty much right now. It's beyond Toyota's ability or any one car manufacturer's or, in fact, the whole auto industry's ability to make this happen. What you have to have is a willing public, mass transit planners, urban planners, and regulatory people all working together on a common goal. And the other thing is, you really what works in New York might not work in San Francisco and won't work in Los Angeles. So you lose this economy of scale as you recreate the systems.
Again, Bill Reinhardt is national manager for Toyota's Advanced Technology Group. Very interested to get Peter DiLorenzo's views on what we've just heard. Again, the founder and publisher of AutoExtremist.com. It sounds as if cars might be faded out or phased out or at least integrated into a much more complex system relatively soon.
Well, I can see that happening in some of the large metroplexes in the U.S., but I also think that the concept of personal mobility will be with us indefinitely. And Toyota, as Bill knows, has worked on these single-person mobility types of vehicles. And I really think, yes, there will be a need for mass embracing of solutions for crowded urban areas. But I also think that, you know, the concept of personal mobility is going to be strong indefinitely because people really like being able to do their own thing, and I hope they do for a long time to come.
Ronald Reagan used to say it was the car that made us free, particularly in Los Angeles, but there are a lot of people who feel enslaved to their cars, aren't they? Don't you think, Peter DiLorenzo, even though you're obviously favorably inclined to the car industry, that there are some downsides here?
Oh, there are some downsides, and especially when you live in a crowded urban area, when you're forced with fees everywhere you go, it can be a real drawback. But I do think that personal mobility will be with us for a long time to come.
Bill Reinert, how long do you think it'll be before there is a willing public, in addition to a government that might want to push the public along, for the kinds of changes you're talking about?
Well, that's first of all, I want to say I agree with Peter. The need for personal mobility is always going to exist, and not everybody is going to live in a urban dense environment. So you're going to have personal and individually owned applications, and personal and non-individually owned applications. But you ask a really good question: is how soon can we prepare society? And that's actually a different role, and it's the automakers can work on it, and the regulatory agencies can work on it. But the fact of the matter is, what's happened is the regulatory agencies has made the automakers make a car, but they can't make the consumers buy the car. And you see that again and again. And so there's a great deal of societal education that has to occur.
Okay. We will see how that moves along with time, and talk more about it on future programs. Thank you so much for being with us. Bill Reinert, National Manager for Toyota's Advanced Technology Group, Peter DiLorenzo with AutoExtremist.com, Wes Brown at Iceology, Bert Bachman at Galpin Ford in Los Angeles, and David Shepardson with the Detroit News. Pakistan's President Asif Ali Zardari is a much weakened figure after this weekend's failure to squelch a national protest. In a moment, we'll get the latest from an unstable nation with nuclear arms on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point, or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Over the weekend, a massive demonstration forced Pakistan's President Zardari to restore Chief Justice Mohammad Chaudhry, who was forced out by former President Pervez Musharraf. And Zardari was also forced to make a deal with the opposition leader, Nawaz Sharif. Najam Sethi is editor of the national newspaper Daily Times, published in Lahore. He's also contributor to The Economist magazine, and it's good to have you back on our program.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Tell us about President Zardari, and to what extent has he been weakened by the fact that the demonstrations went on, he couldn't put them down. Apparently the military said they wouldn't help him do that, and consequently he had to put the Chief Justice back on the bench.
Well, before the demonstrations began, the common perception here is that the Pakistani army and the American administration and their representatives in Pakistan stitched together a compromise, a reconciliation deal between Mr. Zardari and Mr. Sharif, the leader of the opposition. And the contours of that deal included the restoration of the former Chief Justice Iftikhar Chaudhry, followed up by various other steps, which would ultimately culminate in a repeal of an amendment to the Constitution that is at the root of many of our problems. So the first step in that was to call off the Long March. Mr. Sharif refused. He said no, he would continue with the Long March because calling it off would have created difficulties and indicated that he might have struck a deal behind the scenes. He didn't want to be seen as making a deal. So he continued to carry on with the Long March. Eventually, the army prevailed upon Mr. Zardari not to let the Long March continue because it felt there might be violence and things could get out of hand. So Mr. Zardari then ended up conceding in a late-night move a statement that meant that the Chief Justice would stand restored in about 4 or 5 days from now. And then the Long March was called off. Now, there are various elements to this deal, including the restoration of the Chief Justice, the terms and conditions on which he's been restored, what he's likely to do, what he's not going to do, some informal guarantees that have been obtained by the Americans and the army from all the players in Pakistan, the government, the opposition, and the Chief Justice. Much of this is under wraps, so we don't know how the whole situation will pan out. But we do know that each of the three players are extremely unreliable and untrustworthy. The Chief Justice is a bit of a maverick. President Zardari has been trying to hog all the power, and Mr. Sharif wants to force through an early election. So their motives are mixed and not entirely trustworthy. So people have reacted to the calling off of the Long March and the announcement that the Chief Justice will be restored with a sense of relief and partial victory. But there's also disquiet in terms of what next? When will they start slugging it out again?
Is the U.S. Effectively propping up either one or another of the players in this situation?
Well, the U.S. was interested in seeing a continuation of the Zardari regime for two reasons. First of all, it's a democratically elected regime. It's barely 1 year in power, and it obviously deserves to run its full course, no matter some bad decisions that it's taken and a degree of unpopularity that has immediately hit it. But for another reason, that Mr. Zardari is solidly on board with American national interests in this region. He thinks that those are also in Pakistan's interests. So he's a good friend and ally to the United States, and he's also democratically elected. But unfortunately, he's unpopular now, and Mr. Sharif is becoming more and more popular. So on the one hand, the Americans are keen to prop up and to support Mr. Zardari. On the other hand, they do not want a confrontation between the opposition and Zardari that leads to the fall of the government. And in a sense, either the return of the army, which would be disastrous because the army would not be able to deal with the myriad problems that face Pakistan, least of all, openly become an American ally in a country which is hugely anti-American right now. And also Mr. Sharif, whose record is a bit checkered in terms of his support or lack of it for the war on terror, which is a primary American objective here. So the Americans have played their cards reasonably well in the last 10, 15 days. They've supported a reconciliation that stops the destabilization of the government and of the country.
You say they played their cards reasonably well. Has there been a change in that regard since the Bush administration?
Yes, I think the Bush administration was too closely linked with the unpopular Musharraf regime. And so therefore, neither the regime nor President Bush had any credibility here. Now there's been an election, and the Americans have said that they will support whichever government is in power. And of course, the Zardari government is in power. And so the Americans are propping up Mr. Zardari, both in terms of committing themselves to economic and military aid to get the economy back on track. And also expecting that the Pakistan government will then do more to help the Americans in the war on terror. Mr. Sharif, as I said, has been lukewarm in offering such support. So in that sense, the new American administration has tried to distance itself from the legacy of Mr. Bush. But at the same time, there is no new policy in Afghanistan. And until Mr. Holbrook, the new regional envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan, unveils a new strategy, and until Congress sanctions new economic and military aid to Pakistan, one is not entirely clear what the U.S.-Pakistan relationship will look like, say, 3 months from now.
Richard Holbrooke met with the opposition leader, Mr. Sharif. Apparently, they said they got along well. Is it possible that he's looking at Sharif as a kind of bridge to the Taliban, or at least to those in the Muslim, what are called the more extreme Muslim parts of the country, in order to try to make some kind of a deal with them?
Well, Mr. Holbrooke is concerned about two things. Number one, he's concerned that the Zardari administration should get the support of Mr. Sharif, certainly as far as fighting the war on terror is concerned. Because the bigger the consensus in the country to fight that war, the better it is from America's point of view. And currently, that is not the situation. Although Mr. Zardari seems to be the loner out there who's, in a sense, supporting the fight on terror. And he's unpopular partly for that reason, because he's seen to be too close to the Americans. Mr. Sharif has played his cards reasonably well. Privately, he's assured the Americans that he's on board. Publicly, he's not making any such statement because it would be construed as being unpopular. You want to stay away from the Americans in public. And so that is the situation. And so I think the Americans have been talking to Mr. Sharif and trying to get him to support the government, at least on this one major point. In return, I think they've leaned on Mr. Zardari to open up avenues for power sharing with Mr. Sharif rather than push him to the wall and then get him to look angry and take advantage of the anti-Americanism in the country.
All right. Well, we always learn a great deal when you're on our program, and thank you very much for being with us again. Najam Sethi, editor of the Daily Times, published in Lahore, Pakistan, also a contributor to The Economist magazine. Thanks again.
You're welcome.
Today's program produced by Sonia Geis with Katie Cooper and Gary Scott. Our technical director is Mario Saavedra. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/To The Point. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.